perhaps there will be. I have something I want to share with you, sort of to get us started. We have said most this week about the methodology of neo-Darwinism to bridge the gaps between the kinds, what the Bible generally calls the kinds, through the process of mathematical extrapolation. That is to say that what happens to make one, what happens in the process of creating various families or various varieties of reptile, if you just leave that process alone long enough, it will produce birds. And other reptiles, if you just leave them alone, that the process that takes cold-blooded animals and turns them, they will gradually turn them into warm-blooded animals. And that this thing of extrapolation. Well, this has been looked down upon for a long time. Way back in the 19th century, Mark Twain, when this was beginning to be done, Mark Twain, who was something of one of my favorite characters, although he was something of an agnostic and cynical fella, he noticed that this didn't make a whole lot of sense. And he wrote one of the classic statements, evaluations of the methodology of extrapolation. You all know what I'm talking about now? And this is what he wrote. I just can't let a weekend go by without laying a little Mark Twain on you. He says, in the space of 176 years, the lower Mississippi has shortened itself 242 miles. That's an average of a trifle over a mile and a third a year. Therefore, any calm person who is not blind or idiotic can see that the old Olytic Silurian period, that in the old Olytic Silurian period, just a million years ago next November, the lower Mississippi River was upward of 1,300,000 miles long and stuck out over the Gulf of Mexico like a fishing rod. And by the same token, any person can see that 742 years from now, the lower Mississippi will be only a mile and three quarters long. And Cairo, that's Cairo, Illinois, and New Orleans will have joined streets together and be plodding along comfortably under a single mayor and a mutual board of aldermen. just by extrapolation. In this last sentence, the last two sentences, he says, there is something fascinating about science. One gets such wholesale returns of conjecture out of such a trifling investment of fact. Well, I enjoyed that, even if you didn't. There is one area that is one of the newest areas of argument, and this is rather complex. I say this for the last, I don't know why, maybe to kind of prepare you for it, but I'm not going to spend much time on this because it is rather technical. I've tried not to get too technical this week. But one of the latest attempts to establish neo-Darwinism, and as a matter of fact, it is a refinement of the method of extrapolation, is what is called the electrophoretic approach. What that word means is, now, the technology was developed, what it means is this. The technology was developed in about 1960, in the late 60s, to trace sequences of various chemicals in animals and in men. You can trace amino acid sequences and protein acids, protein sequences, trace what's called DNA hybridization. What this means is, and to simplify it, it's this, that according to the theory of evolution, genetic change brings about morphological change. Now, that is, as the genes change, then the shape of the body, the form of the body changes along with it. Morphology simply means the study of the shape of the body. And that is why, that is, there was a genetic change that took place over long, vast periods of time, and gradually the shape of man changed. He lost his supraorbital ridge. His forehead rounded out, his head moved back on his spinal column, morphological change. And therefore, according to this theory, if you can trace these chemical sequences in man, there's various ones you can use, amino acids or proteins or DNA, in the DNA, you should get a parallel. But as you can see parallels between different animals or see similarities, mathematical ratios in various animals in these sequences, they should match up morphologically. Do you get that? Let me say it again. That is, if they show similarities, that is, they show patterns of with high percentages of similar amino acid sequences in the DNA, then they should have corresponding, they should look alike and act alike. They should be of the same species. And so this was a great way, and there have been many attempts to trace, and by the way, this has been made possible by two, in the area of technology, by two things mainly, the electron microscope, which is, and various technologies that enables scientists to isolate these elements within, in chemical elements in animals and man, and the computer, which enables them to correlate the data. And so what evolutionists are doing now are very happily running computer readouts on amino acid sequences and using some of this material, trying to use some of this material in various ways to establish that men and that hominid and pongid, that is man, that we have a common ancestor, try to trace the, in other words, they would try to take the trace the amino sequences and other chemical analyses in man and in the chimpanzee, for instance, and try to extrapolate these backward with the computer and show a direct mathematical correlation back to the common ancestor. Am I making sense to you all? It's quite complicated, but and they chart these out, they read these out in what are called cladograms. And if you like a graph somewhat, and the lines should all match out, and they should converge at this common line, because that's the law of genetic change. Well, as a matter of fact, it hasn't worked. And remember, let me give you an example. Remember the first thing I shared with you on Friday night was this message by Dr. Colin Patterson, who is the senior paleontologist and editor of the journal at the British Museum of Natural History in London. He was speaking before some of the world's top evolutionists at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. This is November of 1981. Who gets up and says, fellas, he announced he'd become a creationist. One of the top 10 evolutionists in the world, saying he's bailing. Not a biblical creationist, a systematic creationist. He did not take a stand for Genesis. What he said was, by a systematic creationist, he means, I don't know, what he was saying is, I don't know how it came into being, but neo-Darwinism doesn't tell us anything about how the present order came into being. It tells us how it got refined, perhaps, but not how it came into being. You recall that statement I read? And when this is the copy of his speech, and the bulk of it, he is analyzing this latest evidence, or this latest approach, using the cladograms. And he points out that it doesn't work. What was supposed to be, and this is one of the reasons that he bailed out. This was sort of the last hope of the neo-Darwinist. And when it didn't work, as I understand what he said, he said, fellas, if this doesn't work, we might as well give up on the thing. And he has given up. He announced himself as a creationist. What he's saying is, and he gave examples, and the chart and the speech contains many examples of this. And he points out that if you can pick certain chemicals. I suggest this one. You pick certain chemicals and run these cladograms, and man comes out very similar to the chimpanzee. As a matter of fact, in some things, he is too similar. But the line just run parallel, except that the morphology doesn't match up. He doesn't look enough like a chimpanzee. On the other hand, you can pick different chemicals and run them, and it goes off this way. There's no correlation whatever. As I said, if you can trace some chemicals, and if you run some of these, and it depends on which one you pick, some of them, I said, Dr. Gish of the Creation Research Society, who's a biochemist in California, he picked certain chemicals and proved that man's closest relative is the soybean. It just depends on which one you want to pick. And so what evolutionists are doing now is they're picking certain ones that fit the closest, that seem to fit, and using that as evidence, ignoring the ones that don't fit. But this is what he said. I don't want to spend too much time on the press. I'm confusing you. He says this. and he's talking about those who are trying to go to the textbooks and in the textbooks establish neo-Darwinism on the basis of molecular biology. That's the general field, and this method, this approach of comparing genetic change with morphology. This is what he says. So what about the tree here? By the tree, he means these supposed connections, where you can trace, say, the man and the chimp to a common ancestor. What about the tree here? And by the way, you can't see it here, but he's on the blackboard giving a lecture. As Steve said, it is produced by a program, a computer program. Those numbers don't pop out of the data in any way. So I suppose they come from massaging the data with evolutionary theory. You get that? He says they don't come from the data. If they prove evolution, you only get it by massaging the data with the theory. It is a program that assumes evolution to be true and tells the computer to find a tree. You're getting evolution out of the computer but you can't get it out unless you put it in. It is a program that assumes evolution to be true and tells the computer to find a tree. So my question will be, what is the tree telling us? Is it telling us something about nature or something about evolutionary theory? His answer is, it isn't telling us anything about nature, just telling us something about the theory, which he says, which is nice, which is fun. He says, you want to run these cladograms? Everybody's having a great time, except it doesn't say anything about where man came from. Now, I'm not going to say more about that, but I just want you to know that is the latest technological approach of the neo-Darwinists to try to establish evolution. And as Patterson has pointed out, many others have pointed out, it just doesn't work. It's like the transitional fossils. It was supposed to have been there, and when they run them, it doesn't work out. So what the evolutionists have been doing, some of them are doing with this data the same thing they've done with every other data. You see, they can preserve the theory as long as they take certain evidence, as long as they practice what I call evolutionary natural selection. The evolutionists naturally select the evidence they're going to use. It's like in dating the Earth. They kind of naturally select the evidence which makes the Earth appear to be vastly old and very conveniently don't. So they find much evidence that says it's not that old, and so they say, well, that's an anomaly, and they just sort of, it's the force of natural selection. It's a certainly field in my area, the area of anthropology. I pointed out last night there are many skeletons and skulls that have been very ancient, have been found, which don't fit the program, so they just sort of get selected against. they lose out in the battle of the survival of the fittest. The fittest in this case being those that fit the diagrams. And they practice that systematically, and what he says is we're practicing it here. But the ones that seem to fit are going to, listen, count on it. You can just count on it. The ones that seem to fit, the readouts that seem to fit, picking certain chemicals, will end up in the textbooks. I'd bet my life on it. That is the standard methodology. And I just want you to know that one of the top men in the world has recently pointed out that it doesn't work. You only get it by programming the computer to tell you what you want it to tell out the other end, massaging the data with the theory, as he put it. Well, any questions on that? Anybody? Yes. Oh, well, most of it's through universities, and I don't have any idea. It's a great deal of money. They've been working a long time on it. Yes, much of it is. Yes. Well, I just thought I didn't feel it would be right to go through the whole weekend and not at least introduce to you briefly that area of investigation, because it is very important. I'm kind of working at random. Let me share something else with you. In reviewing this book, remember I shared last night that I was able to get a book, an anthropology text, thrown off the approved list in the state of Florida by doing a selective analysis of it. And let me share a little bit of that. Let me give you a statement from the book. And I do this because we have so many young people here tonight. This was the statement. First of all, it's a book. The book was by a man called Salzman. The title was simply Anthropology, put out by Harcourt Brace Janovich in New York. By the way, they've been using it since 1973. You're not using it anymore in Florida, this is what he said. I'm quoting now, at the opening of the book, page 4, as a matter of fact. Now listen to this kind of thing. All scientists today agree that man is a member of the animal kingdom. Now, that is a standard textbook statement. Salzman did not get thrown off because he's the only one who said that. He had to stand in line for that privilege. You got that? All scientists today agree that man is a member of the animal kingdom. Not only does man closely resemble other members of the order of primates to which he himself belongs, the gorillas, chimpanzees, other apes, and monkeys, but he shares basic anatomical features such as the diversified animal species such as cats, frogs, and sparrows. Well, I'm commenting on his statement. All scientists today agree that man is a member of the animal kingdom. Here was my comment. It's simply not true that all scientists accept the naturalistic evolutionary concept of man and his history. To affirm this is both a logical and a phenomenological error. Then I cite as my authority. Each case I had to cite as authority. And I cite as my authority. Again, I did not cite a single creationist in this report, in this analysis. And I cited C. Everett Olson, who's a professor of geology at the University of Chicago. If anything about the University of Chicago, it's not exactly a Bible college. So Dr. Olson at the University of Chicago wrote this in his book, Morphology, Paleontology, and Evolution. It's a chapter in a book. I'm sorry, that's a chapter, Morphology, Paleontology, and Evolution, in a book called The Evolution of Life, put out by the University of Chicago Press. This is what he says. Now I'm quoting, understand, another evolutionist. And so you have one, you have an anthro. Now listen, here's what you have. You see, remember, I've tried to point out the difference between what I call Godfather evolution and textbook evolution. So you have a high school textbook that was used from 1973 until last year when we got it thrown off. It said this, all scientists agree that man is a member of the animal kingdom. Then you get a graduate level textbook put out by the University of Chicago, not a high school textbook, and here's what he says. There exists, as well, a generally silent group of students engaged in biological pursuits who tend to disagree with much of the current thought, but say and write very little because they are not particularly interested, do not see that controversy over evolution is of any particular importance, or are so strongly in disagreement that it seems futile to undertake the monumental task of controverting the immense body of information and theory, got that, information and theory, that exists in the formulation of modern thinking. It is, of course, and what he's talking about that vast number of, or that number, whatever it is, of biochemists and paleontologists and others who are not evolutionists. This is what he says. It is, of course, difficult to judge the size and composition of this silent segment, but there is no doubt that the numbers are not inconsiderable. So you get a high school textbook that says all scientists are evolutionists. But now Salzman wrote that. Salzman knows that's not true. Understand that? He knows that's not true, unless he's had his head in the sack for the last 40 years. He knows that's not true. Now, why would he put that in a high school textbook when one of the nation's leading evolutionists, Olson at University of Chicago, why wouldn't he write something like that? The answer is he wouldn't dare, because he's writing a book to operate at a different level. And if he wrote that at that level, he would be, the high school kids aren't going to call Salzman on this. You say, they don't know the difference. It sounds like, well, yeah, all scientists are evolutionists. But when Olson writes, he is writing to the academic community at the upper levels, and he knows that they know that if he said all scientists are evolutionists, that he would be called on it because it's simply not true. Some of the top scientists at some of our top universities are creationists. And so he reluctantly admits, he softens it as much as he can, but he makes this statement, it is of course difficult to judge the size and composition of this silent segment. One of the reasons they're silent is that the journals won't print their articles. Anyway. But there is no doubt that the numbers are not inconsiderable. You see the conflicting statements? But the conflicting statements correspond to the different levels. And the point I'm trying to make, and I hope I have made it, is that you kids listen. You read a statement like that all scientists are evolutionists. It's in a high school textbook or even a junior high textbook. It simply is not true, and the guy who wrote it probably knows it's not true. Y'all see my point on that? Now, it's coming back to plow some ground again, but I thought giving it to you just that way might be a little bit helpful. Let me share something else with you, and this is a statement, again, by the way, if you notice, I haven't quoted a single creationist this whole weekend. I do have some creationist friends. The reason I don't quote them is that you don't have to. I've talked about the nature of, the Bible says this, God created the world, and he created the biological order to reproduce after its kind. After its kind. I emphatically believe that. That is the scientific view as well as the biblical view. You understand that? That is the scientific view, if you mean by scientific, that which is observed. Observed in the present order, observed in the fossil record. Let me give you a statement by one of the leading evolutionists of our generation, Ludwig von Bertalanffy is his name. He's one of the real biggies. In a book called An Evaluation of Modern Biological and Scientific Thought, in a larger work called Evolution of Man, put out by Oxford University Press in New York, 1970. He said this. Now, he's an evolutionist and a confirmed evolutionist. Here, I'm quoting now. Here becomes an important problem. The theory of evolution, based upon an enormous amount of factual evidence, that is, of microevolution, he means, states that the animal and plant kingdoms, this is what the theory states, have arisen in the course of geological time from simpler and more primitive forms to more complicated and more highly organized ones. Genetical experience leads us to accept as a fact that this has happened by way of step-like mutation, that is, microevolution. However, we find no evidence. Keep in mind, this is not a creationist speaking. We find no evidence, either in the living world of today or of past geological ages, for a continuous transition. Even the existence of more or less numerous mutations, races, subspecies, and so forth within the species does not alter the basic fact that the intermediate stages from one species to another, which should be found if there were gradual transition, are not met with. They are not there. The world of organisms, living and extinct, does not represent a continuum, but a discontinuum. Remember I put on the board yesterday? Does not represent this mega evolution continuum, but a discontinuum. Now, that is a very clear statement of the nature of that. Now, that is not the kind of thing you read in textbooks. In other words, in the textbooks, they say this. Well, the evidence, the scientists have looked at the evidence, and they have determined that there's a continuum from the gases struck by lysine, producing amino acids, producing proteins, producing cells, all the way up to man. But Bertalanffy would never dare say that at the level he's working, because he knows it's not true. That's what you get, it is not there. And what he's saying is, what we find is exactly what the book of Genesis would tell us to expect to find. And that is, reproducing after their kind, that and nothing else. Well, is that interesting to you? That's a representative statement. By the way, it's on the basis of material like that that I was able to get the book thrown off. Statements like that. Do you have any questions on that? I told you I was kind of tight. Yes, sir. You mean philosophically or scientifically to believe in? Well, they have plenty of evidence of microevolution, like you say. And they have their computer readouts and their mathematical models. Well, interesting question. Here's what they say. Here's what some of them say. And this is very subtle. I'm glad you brought this up. Let me address myself to this for just a minute. Evolutionists like to say, a theory is just a working hypothesis. And we're open-minded, and we are always ready to be told that we're wrong so that we can move on to another hypothesis. And I demonstrated yesterday that that's okay as long as the other hypothesis is also evolution. This philosophical barrier. Remember, I quoted Simpson that we'll simply look for nothing but purely natural or physical answers to the questions. Now, and they say, you creationists, you're absolutist. You know what you know and you won't change, which is not true. Nobody's any more absolutist than an evolutionist, confirmed evolutionist. Very absolutist. But what they say is this to each other, and if you press them on it, they say, well, that's true. If you point out the weaknesses of a hypothesis, say the neo-Darwinian hypothesis, they will get very scientific and very philosophical. They'll say something like this. Well, yes, that's true. We realize it has real serious defects, but you understand how a hypothesis works in the area of science. A hypothesis is a working model, gives us something to work with so that we can, it's like a stepping stone to something else. Well, that's fair enough if they want to talk like that, but why don't they say that in the textbooks? When it comes to the textbooks, that's not that at all. It is all scientists, I just read, all scientists believe that in evolution. Well, that's true, but if they said to the kids, we have found that this thing doesn't work very often. This model doesn't work. This hypothesis really is a big disappointment, and we're looking for another one, but in the meantime, it's kind of stick with us. They don't word it that way. What the kids get is, well, if you're intelligent, you're an evolutionist. So it's really a speak with forked tongue. And they take on an air of liberality, that is an air of openness, which is really not true. For instance, the extremes they'll go, rather than throw out the theory, like Gould and Eldridge and their systematic mutation or punctuated equilibrium, where you get a reptile lays an egg and hatches a bird. What they're saying is, if we have to say that to preserve the theory, that's what we're going to say. Understand? Now, if a creationist says something like that, they'd fall down in a faint. They get the vapors. If a creationist reasoned like that, but they'll reason like that other than cross that philosophical line into creationism, which they're simply not going to do. Many are. Say Patterson has, and many others are doing it. By the way, I would simply point out that I haven't already said this, that the leaders for the creation side of this debate are not the preachers. The leaders are the scientists. However, it's interesting, but the evolutionists categorically deny that. When I was having this discussion, which I've alluded to a couple of times, I pointed this out to Dr. Wilson, who wrote the primary author of the Humanist Manifesto. I said, do you realize that the leaders on our side are not the preachers, it's the biochemists and the geneticists? And we were sitting right there with the hope for the, and he simply denied it. He said, that's simply not true. All scientists are evolutionists, he said. That's roughly, in our day and age, that's roughly the intellectual equivalent of saying the world is flat. But that's what he said. He's very religious. That's a very religious way to think, if you know how I use the word religious. Any other questions? Yes. I don't know. Probably are. Mainly the uninformed. Gracious. Let me share something else with you while I still have time. As I say, I'm kind of tying up loose ends. I talk about the cladograms, computerized biochemistry. There is another area, an argument that gets in the textbooks, but which is not in, which is often sort of brought in sideways in the textbooks, but does not appear in the arguments at the upper levels. That is the argument. See, the real problem is trying to explain how life got started without a creator. And he says this. I'm quoting again this. Here it is. One of the arguments is that in the textbooks is to use as a model for prebiotic forms or the kinds of life that had to exist before the fully functioning, self-replicating cell. They use the virus. The virus is a very simple, comparatively simple. The virus is a comparatively simple life form. Now, I say comparatively simple. If you think it's simple, go build one. Anyway. way. They are not simple at all. They are comparatively simple. And because the virus is comparatively more simple than the one-celled, self-replicating, self-sustaining life form, creature or form, they like to suggest the existence of a virus gives us insight into how life made this transition from simple protein molecules to the cell. That somehow that's a bridge in there. This is what Salzman wrote. Viruses are parasitic, that is, they are dependent on other already existing organisms. But apart from this, I love this. But apart from this peculiarity, the protein makeup and the twofold nature of viruses places them at the very threshold of life. Now, a scientist knows that that statement is not science. That statement is poetry. And if you're going to write, nothing wrong with poetry, but get over to the literature department, English department, have your poetry over there. Don't bring it into the science lab. Understand? To say it's parasitic. Apart from this peculiarity, that it cannot exist unless it has a higher form of life to be its host. Other than that, it's right. Listen to this. It's at the very threshold of life. Now, what does that mean? Here was my comment. The introduction of viruses as a key to understanding how non-living matter bridged the gap to living matter is grossly unscientific. Salzman's statement above is contradictory and nonsensical. The virus is an obligate parasite and cannot procreate without the simultaneous existence of the cell. To place the virus at the very threshold of life is poetry and not science. Now, what I want to say is that you get the virus in the textbooks. You do not have the upper echelon evolutionists arguing from the virus. That they tried that at one time and got to thinking about it. I think it lasted 3 days. I'm being facetious, but it simply is not used. But it is a very convenient thing to put in a textbook because it sounds reasonable. Now, I'm trying to make this a practical weekend as much as I can. Now, that is an example of an argument that you see at one level and do not see at another level. Do you have any questions on that? Okay, now, we got about 10 minutes left, a little bit more. Are there any questions about anything that we've covered this weekend? Something you've just been dying to ask? And haven't done so. Anybody? Or I want to make comments. Yes. Oh no, evolution can't. The question was, does evolution think are the end product? No, you can't end it. They have a real problem with that because even if you accept their geologic time scale, which I do not, there are many forms which have not changed since the Triassic age. There are many forms which are absolutely the same as they are in the fossils, which are supposed to be several million years old. And so one of the real problems that evolutionists have is they have a real problem getting it going. But once they get it going in terms of their theory, they have a real problem getting it stopped. You see, what they do is, for instance, you have this whole thing of living fossils. Let me give an example of some of the... I just happen to have this in my file, I think, here. That's an excellent question. You at least it's a better question than you knew. And here's the real problem they're having. You see, if you sort of get the thing going, theoretically going through these mathematical models, if you say, given enough time, change is inevitable. Given enough time, change is inevitable in terms of these mathematical models, then it leaves them no way to explain when change doesn't happen. If change is inevitable, what about the many forms, insects, living animals, The bat, for instance, hadn't changed a lick since way before the age of the big dinosaurs, using their time scale. Then all of a sudden you got to change horse in the middle of the stream and argue from something else. Well, they found their ecological niche. There was no more selective pressure upon them. Therefore, all the genetic changes were selected against and it stayed the same. You know, you can see how that works. You just question, why doesn't it work with everything else? What it does, it makes time, you see? Well, then the difference is the selective pressure. Except now they're saying that natural selection has nothing to do with evolution. It's all genetics. You see, if it's all natural selection and no genetic mutation, then you can get it going. You see, it's all natural selection, no genetic mutation. You can stop it, but you can't get it going with that theory. So you go back to what are you with me? So we go back to what Gould has done and what Goldschmidt tried in 1940 and say it's not natural selection; it's all mutations. There's got to be so many mutations in certain many years, and so many of these got to be survived. And then you can't get it stopped, and you can't explain those that didn't change. Because if mutation is the agent of change and natural selection isn't the factor, then you can't explain why they didn't change. I don't think that made any sense, whatever, what I just said. But take my word for it. No. Did you follow that? In other words, they have to build these theoretical models to get it going, and then it doesn't explain non-evolution. What I just said was really important. To the question. Any other question? Well, I'm afraid to ask now. Theistic evolution? Yeah. Theistic evolution, by the way, that is the official position of the Roman Catholic Church, stated in Vatican II, theistic evolution. They've been teaching it for years, but now it's the official position from Rome. Theistic evolution is a cop-out. It's not good theology. I think I said this, and it's not good science. I'll tell you why. You see, either evolution is scientifically viable. It is either it is empirically verifiable or rationally coherent, or it isn't. Got that? It either is empirically verifiable or rationally coherent, or it isn't. And if it isn't, you don't make it that way by letting God preside over it some way. It's not good theology. For instance, evolution, one of the primary things that evolution destroys is the concept of the fall of man, the Adamic fall. And the atoning work of Christ is theologically based upon, the doctrine of the fall. You follow me? If you take away the doctrine of the fall, you do not have the doctrine of redemption through the blood of Christ. Bad theology. But it's bad science. Now, there is an organization, the American Scientific Affiliation, generally defends the position of theistic evolution, although they have not stated it. It's a group of evangelicals who are believers in the Bible, basically, but who tend to be theistic evolutionists. And I got a tape debate between a theistic evolutionist and Dr. Gish, the biochemist who works with the Creation Research Society. And Dr. Gish asked this man to explain abiogenesis. We talk about, you know, the lightning striking the ammonia gas and the methane. And he pointed out that the thing wouldn't work. Well, the man said, of course, God was there. You know, I haven't ruled out providence, he said. Well, I'll tell you, if you're a theistic evolutionist, I just urge you to restudy it. And I will grant you one thing, if you're a theistic evolutionist, on the basis of the lack of empirical verification and rational coherency of the theory, it'd take an act of God to make it work. But it doesn't. What I'm saying is, it doesn't solve anything. That, in my opinion, others will disagree with me, of course, but in my opinion, theistic evolution. You understand what we're talking about? Theistic, the idea that God created the world somehow presided over evolution to produced man. That is the non-thinker's position. That's the easy way out. Sounds very convenient to say that. By the way, at one time in my life, I was a theistic evolutionist. And then I studied theology, and I studied science. And I lost my theistic evolution on both sides. You understand? It isn't good theology, it isn't good science. It doesn't really answer anything. Theistic evolution answers nothing. It simply avoids the issue. Now, that's my evaluation of it. A theistic evolution would disagree with that. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And I don't think we ought to embarrass God by bringing him into it. Well, first, I'll give you an example. And one another comment, it creates more problems than it raises more questions than it answers. For instance, did the monkey have a soul? And if he became man gradually, at what point did he suddenly have a soul? Did he become an image? Where did he get to be in the image of God? Yeah. That's a real question, you see. It's raised if you take theistic evolution. Well, I hope you understood my answer to that. We got about 4 or 5 minutes. Any other questions? Yes.
To what extent do you think the flood of Noah's day is responsible for the existence of the fossil?
I'm convinced it's responsible for much of it. But again, the geologic data is so confused and so contradictory. And so much, I think that we need to wait for a better answer, you know, a good answer on that. But I think it's responsible for much of it. I think it's very clear that it is. At least some flood was. I mean, you can't walk the earth without finding where there's been you cannot walk a square inch of the earth. Not a square inch of the earth, and you go to the highest mountain. I don't care where it is, you cannot find a square inch of Mother Earth that does not show evidence of a catastrophic flood. Now, is it Noah? So it's either Noah's flood or some other flood. Now, the question of whether universal flood, and I do hope for a universal flood, although I think there are some real problems with that. But again, I think part of the problems are that the data we're working with is so in such bad shape. Again, that's my evaluation of it, and there are many who would disagree with that. Let me say this. Our time is up. I want to express my appreciation. I realize this is a very specialized subject, and one that not everybody is interested in. And I don't think you have to be interested in it. If it doesn't bother you, don't worry about it. I don't think you ought to try to, you know, become interested in it if you're not. If you are content with your understanding of the beginnings of things and that particular subject doesn't interest you, it doesn't mean you're a poor Christian. But I appreciate the wisdom of a congregation like this in introducing these specialized subjects into your church program and talking about them, because many are interested. And I think there are many people who have legitimate answers. Let me end by saying one of the things I said at the beginning. Evolutionists that you meet are not criminals, and they're not stupid, and they are not dishonest. I think there is some dishonesty, but the dishonesty is upstairs. You know what I mean by that. Evolution is not because it is exceedingly complicated. It's exceedingly complicated, and from the inside, a beautiful building. A lot of money has been spent on it. The technology of the building is magnificent. It has computers in it. It has science labs. It has vast archives of information. A lot of important people live there. It's in an honored place. It's a magnificent structure. It's huge. It's attractive. And as long as you stay in the building, it will appear that way. But you have to get out of the building, walk across the street, and look at this magnificent structure. And when you do that, when you leave the building and walk across the street and look at it, you notice something. It doesn't have any foundation. And I think you ought to think of many evolutionists that way. Many of them were born in the building, in a sense. They were raised in it. They have been told that it's the fundamental principle of science, which you cannot have modern science without evolution. It's absolutely false. That's not true at all. So we treat someone who's never had the privilege. And so what I've tried to do this week with you is help you to walk across the street and look at it and say, it's a tremendous structure, but it doesn't have any foundation. And many are, to mix my metaphors somewhat, many evolutionists are leaving the building, like Patterson, many, many others. And they're walking across the street and looking at it and saying, I think we better leave this thing before it collapses. And it's just sort of hanging there in air, intellectually. Thank you very much for having this. It's been a real personal joy to me to get to see some of you again, to meet some of you for the first time. And God bless you. Come down to Orlando and see us. Come to Central Florida Bible College. We'll give you anything you want to eat. You just bring it and we'll cook it. I'm seriously, if you get down that way, do stop by and see us. Pray for us, and God bless you and the church family here. And I hate to rush like this, but I think it's time to go.